What is up, everyone? My name is Adnan Shafi, and welcome to season 13. Yes, we've come this far, season 13 of Parai Nation. And we're going to be moving in a bit of a different direction, looking to get into more post-colonial issues, but we'll also be discussing some pre-colonial issues, but more looking towards issues of global political economy and obviously theories in relation to international and multilateral organizations and how they've affected us today. So obviously we have two very special guests. We'll start off with Mikhail. Just tell us who you are, where you're from, what you're studying, and why you're on our podcast today.
Thank you, Adnan. Hello, everyone. My name is Mikhail Nyamoya. I'm a final year student at the United States International University Africa. That's in Nairobi, Kenya. I happen also to be in Nairobi at the moment. I'm very passionate about international relations because I also happen to be an international relations student. So these issues to do with international organizations, international law, international criminal court, these are things that really matter to me. And I would want to give a little bit of context and an epistemological approach to whatever we are going to discuss today. So thank you for the invitation.
Awesome stuff. I should probably also just add, but yeah, I'm also just studying at Cardiff University. I'm studying a mixture of law and politics. So it's an LLB, law and politics. But this semester, I'm going to be focusing on colonialism, global political economy, and development. And I definitely take an interest in the idea of multilateral organizations, the concept of neocolonialism, and how that fits into the modern day. So now let's hear from Mustafa. Tell us a bit more about yourself.
Hello, everyone. My name is Mustafa. I go by Fear and Trembling on TikTok, and that's actually where I met Adnan. I'm a student of philosophy, religion, and ethics going into my second year, and I'm generally interested in politics, theology, philosophy, of course, but and of course, anything related to Africa, whether it be African history or diaspora, but yeah.
Awesome, 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 guys. Just in the sake of time, we're going to get right into the topic. But even before we discuss ICC, I think it's so important for us to actually look at the bigger picture and look at the, and let's trace back where all of these international organizations came from. So it goes without saying that majority of these institutions that are international, worldwide, and are geared towards world cooperation, they have colonial roots, and it's not a controversial statement. And we're not necessarily arguing that they are overtly racist, but we are arguing that they have inherited structures of racism, imperialism, and neo-imperialism. And this includes organizations such as the United Nations. This includes organizations such as the IMF, the World Bank, and the newly founded ICC. And we're obviously trying to say that that is reversible. It's definitely, we can be able to suggest changes in the future, but it's important for us to recognize these things and not to shy away from them. Because the moment that we put too much faith in these international organizations, some of us tend to get disappointed. So, I mean, I'm just gonna start off with, for example, the League of Nations. This is something that came before the UN and was actually, people called the UN before the UN. A lot of these ideas came from there. But just to sort of tell you about these colonial roots, from the article number 22, the Covenant of the League of Nations, you actually find that it does mention things like, for example, you know, supporting these peoples who are not yet able to stand for themselves, or they describe this sort of organization as a sacred trust of civilization. So you already have this concept that these European and Western powers have the world. They have to take care of the world. And there's essentially this white man's burden that you find in Rudyard Kipling's poem. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I think you beautifully described it, actually, because the implication here is that their morality or their sense of morality is much higher than ours, and they have to take care of us, and they have to investigate, and they have to go on boots on the ground, something that they've taken on themselves as the white man's burden. But it's beyond comprehension. Like, we can't even think about a scenario in which
an African nation can go to the to America or can go to U to the UK and actually investigate the UK for its war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan, and same with America. But it's perfectly reasonable for them to go into any country and under this guise, you know, do all sorts of brutality themselves.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think that if you even just look at international organizations and the way they've implemented this sort of ideology, you can literally see it in studies. It's not controversial. We're not here like, you know, some ultra radical Afrocentrists that are here to conjure up this conspiracy theory to sort of seduce people into believing that, oh, the world is against us all. No, that's not what we're trying to say, right? You can literally go into the studies, you can go into the studies that have been written by organizations such as the IMF and the World Bank. And if you read the tone in which like they're actually addressing African countries, even from what I just mentioned from the Covenant of the League of Nations, you can definitely see that Africans are being infantilized. You can definitely see that Africans are being viewed like children. And essentially this concept of bringing Africans to civilizations is one of the main things that was used to actually justify colonialism and even things like slavery. So this civilizing mission, I mean, let's hear what Mikhail has to say.
Yeah, I'm very happy to deliberate on this particular topic. And I would give a more theoretical perspective towards the same, especially from an international relations perspective. The realism theory of international relations proposes that international organizations tend to serve the interests of hegemons. The hegemons in this case are now these states that you're talking about, the countries from the West, essentially. And on the other hand, if you look at the liberalism theory, it proposes that international organizations are in place to foster cooperation between countries, okay? Countries that are already developed and countries that are still on the way to being developed. So you see, when you argue on those two fronts, there happens to be a paradox. And if you keenly look at the state of affairs as it is, especially in the last 30 years, you'll tend to find that these organizations tend not to foster cooperation, but instead they actually serve the interests of these particular hegemons. And this has been really seen, especially during voting in the United Nations General Assembly. It's either small countries form cocoons in order for them to be able to support specific countries, particularly those ones that are in the P5. And if it's not about those countries, then it's about countries who they cannot be able to have a voice of their own. And that's why when they all talk about question of African agency, that African countries need to have their own voice. I think it's a very noble idea, but it's going to be very, very difficult and it's going to be frustrated by these particular powers. So that was just my take on that.
You know, what's crazy about that is, I mean, a lot of people don't study this history, but I've just been learning it in the last couple of months or so. But I mean, even when, for example, colonialism, you know, and obviously it's debatable and I don't think that colonialism ever stopped. I don't think that happened. It just sort of changed forms. So yes, political independence, we got political independence, but even when certain countries from the global South were debating the concept of being able to structure a new international economic order, and they formed groups like the G77, you can hear the non-alignment movement, et cetera. You have leaders coming together. Even when OPEC was, you know, ranking, I mean, sort of taking up the fuel prices, that was in response to a structural inequality that was inherited from colonialism and was endorsed by and large by Western countries that benefited from the fruits of colonialism. So even this concept of, you know, the fact that we're pushed into this sort of box where, because colonialism had conditioned African countries and several other countries into just becoming these monoculture economies, we're literally exporting one commodity. And then we're just literally at the mercy of these organizations and these powers. So of course, this whole idea of, you know, the liberalism model I am vehemently against that because it seems very much ahistorical to me. Even this concept of a free market, how is it a free market when one side has been looting for 500 years and the other side has been looted from in an almost equal amount of time? Doesn't really make much sense to me.
Just to add on to that, I think beautifully put again, but in my opinion, if they were being objective and they were going to go after these countries that are responsible for crimes, they would go after themselves first for their crimes in the world. Because imagine this, the continent that was at the forefront of colonialism, Europe, and various actors within those countries, the UK, France, Belgium, Germany, come together and now they're going to be the moral authority, despite them being at the forefront of brutality in the continent. So it doesn't make sense, you know. But I think this talks to like a much larger thing. This is the next stage of colonialism. So first it was, you know, looting our wealth with boots on the ground. And now it's looking down at us from like a moral perspective in the fact that we can't, you know, govern ourselves and we can't hold ourselves accountable for crimes. But yeah.
Yeah, it seems very ironic. I mean, how are you going to found a court upon the values of spreading justice and, you know, bringing peace to the world, being a voice for the voiceless, when you yourself are the oppressors in many parts of the world? Like, make it make sense. Like, really make it make sense. Even when it came to the concentration camps, we definitely have concentration camps the Nazis had. Obviously, yeah, there was like mass genocide going on there. No one's like denying that. But people never even talk about, for example, the Japanese concentration camps that they had in the US, or they never really talk about even what's going on in Iraq. And obviously, yeah, the ICC has done a bit of an investigation into this, but remember, the ICC will only intervene where they feel that the state is not doing enough to prosecute these people. And here's the thing, let's actually look at let's even just first of all address who's actually signed and ratified this Rome Statute, which gives validity to the ICC. The USA is not there, right? And I find it very interesting because the US markets themselves as the moral superiority and the moral authority of the world. And Europe to a degree does that. And yeah, that's why, I mean, makes sense. Yeah, Europe has signed and ratified it. But even then, can someone please explain to me why, out of the 11 cases that have been brought to the ICC in terms of investigating, 10 of them have been from the African continent? Why?
I would say the reason that they'd probably give off is that Africa as a continent has been in more wars compared to Europe as a continent or the Americas. So, but then you can make the argument that most of those wars are a consequence of, if not the colonial divide, the imperialism, or the ones in which the US, the CIA specifically, overthrew governments, paid rebel groups to cause, you know, disruptions in economies that were more focused on the nation itself rather than foreign interests. But it still doesn't account for, you know, why not go after America and what they did in Iraq via Abu Ghraib, for example, in which all types of brutality was committed, or, you know, the UK war crimes. But it's clear that it's unquestionably racist, right? Just based on that alone, that it's not holding everyone to the same standard. You know, it's one standard for the victims of imperialism and colonialism, and it's one standard for the perpetrators. The perpetrators can get away with it, but we're going to hold the victims with their wrongdoings, right? Because no one's like defending any of the people prosecuted. But it's clearly racist to me.
No, I totally agree because, I mean, if you look at the way they've really structured their rulings as a court, what does that really imply? I mean, think about it. Ever since the conception of something like slavery, and then you have the propagation of these cartoons of Black men being these aggressors and being these animals, right? Strong animals that are there to rape white women. And I'm literally not even exaggerating. This was one of the key arguments that was pushed by, I think it was called Birth of a Nation. Yes, Birth of a Nation. It was one of the first films that they had showcased in the US. And it was literally about how the KKK came to save the day and this Black man had wanted to rape a white woman. So this concept of like only Black men specifically, only leaders from African lands can fully be seen to, or not even just African lands, like, you know, non-European lands can be seen as these people who are, you know, uncivilized. And obviously they would say that Africans are more likely in this case to fit into that category because it's been so widely propagated. Like people genuinely subconsciously believe this to be the truth. So this is definitely reflected in the rulings. I mean, Mikhail, what do you think?
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate something that you said in October in the podcast that you did then on Pan-Africanism. You said that, who are you to tell us that we cannot have nuclear weapons, whereas you have them stocked in your backyard? Because that clearly shows that there's a sort of double standard principle there. And just to give a little bit of context, in 2010, because I just said that these international organizations essentially serve the interests of hegemons anyway. They don't talk about fostering cooperation or enhancing liberalism. There's nothing like that. They serve the interests of hegemons anyways. So in 2010, during the regime of this guy called Mohammed Ahmadinejad, who was the then president of Iran, the International Atomic Energy Agency banned the nuclear program that Iran had already started. And it was not the International Atomic Energy Agency that did that. Instead, it was the US using the International Atomic Energy Agency that actually did the same thing. And I really wonder, because at the same time you have weapons stocked in your backyard, but at the same time again, you're telling other countries that they're not able to do this. Why? That shows that you've already formed a perception about them. And when we're going to delve a little bit deeper into this discussion, you'll start seeing that there's a difference between reality and perception. And perception is where, if we base our judgments on perceptions, then we are likely to go wrong. In the same way that they are perceiving us as because at some stage they had said that Iran was funding terrorist activities, but there was no direct evidence that it was actually doing that. So I think that is what I could say in that particular context. And as we delve deeper, just as I said, we are going to see how perceptions really play part in this particular discussion.
I just want to add on to the point you're making of them weaponizing independent bodies. I think parallels from that can be seen today with China, how they're using the UN to draw sanctions upon China and put pressure on China for something which they allege is going on. But that was a good point.
I think, you know, I mean, I was reading this article actually. I'm just trying to get the name of the person who had written it, right? I can't really remember the name, but yeah, I think there's an interesting point that he brings up in that article in relation to the concept of new imperialism. And you essentially have an ideology, and this is what I'm starting to see what's common with ideologies that have started to manifest in a time whereby people are always talking about human rights, they're always talking about all these different things. So what essentially you have is the process of othering a group of people. That is the first part. You other a group of people and you label them in a way that makes them not human or worthy of being able to be deprived of their life. That is something that's difficult to do, because you need to prove that those people are either threats or they're oppressing a different group of people, right? And this is exactly where it comes from, right? And I mean, I'll find the quote later, possibly when someone else is speaking, but he literally said that the Cold War was one bit. Everyone focused on what? Communism, right? Once the Soviet Union fell and the Twin Towers fell, that was when they decided that they're going to use radical Islam as a pretext for invasion. Imagine if you tell someone, right, you can walk to anyone on the streets of Europe, walk to any US city, walk in those streets and ask the people, you know, would you support the military if it invaded a place where you reasonably believed that terrorist activities were going on? Let's say, of course, right? But obviously now, you know, when those WMDs were not found in Iraq, what happened? Right?
Yeah.
Do you see where it comes from?
The thing is, it's not only infantilization of these nations. I think it talks to a much larger societal level, societal like issue that is going on, which is, for example, racism, which is a huge topic. Racism in America, how it transpires with police shootings, and then you look at the origin of those police shootings, which we know is nothing to do with the victim. It's all to do with the perpetrator of violence. And the origins, according to the American Psychological Association, is that on average, white police officers would see black men as aggressive, as opposed to the white counterpart. You know, they're just the pure image or the pure presence of a black person is just seen as threatening. So extrapolate that to the larger level, and you see the same thing. Just the pure presence of a black country is something in which white countries just have to do something about, whether it be colonialism, imperialism, and what we see today via its neocolonialism.
I think it's important for us to realize, I mean, yeah, that's a very good point. I think it's important for us to realize, and some people might be asking, you know, how could the ICC possibly be acting in a neocolonial way or be working within neocolonial structures? If it's simply bringing people to justice, there's no resources that they're taking, there's no land that they're taking, there's no profit that they're appropriating from different people who may have earned that profit rightly. So people might be asking, what's going on? But I think it's important for us to see that different international organizations serve different purposes in this whole entire scheme of neocolonization. Very few of these international organizations are going to get their hands dirty physically. It's not going to happen anymore. Because what? Nowadays, we've surpassed. We've gone to that part where the Geneva Convention has been passed, had all these different documents that have proclaimed human rights are good, right? These are the basic human rights that everyone deserves. You have the concept of sustainable development goals, and within those are obviously human beings are taken into account. So you cannot have these international organizations get their hands dirty, at the same time be preaching these values. So what role does the ICC have? It serves the role of a form of psychological neocolonialism that says that we are the lawgivers and we are the ones that will carry the law out. And we've even discussed this on an epistemological level. The ICC and all these international law theories, my question is, how does that court function? Because I'm a law student. I've had the opportunity to look at different, you know, criminal systems, the inquisitorial system, you know, this is the, there's different systems in regards to, you know, obviously standard of proof, evidential rules, all these different things. So how does that court function and take into account all these different countries that are there, right? Obviously, if it's given the world powers that are participating within that court, it's more than likely that it's going to be influenced by a majority of European thought, which is popular in international law. And that's actually what this concept of, like, you know, oh, we have to get the rest of the world human rights. But when it comes to them, the governments are doing shady stuff, right, in different other countries. And we've mentioned all these different things.
Yeah, I think in my view, I would want to give a little bit of a chronological approach, a chronological perspective to what you've just said. You said that you mentioned something to do with the Cold War as well as the 2001 bombing of the Twin Towers. And when you talk about the Cold War, you'll realize that there was a discernible shift in the nature of conflicts after the end of the Cold War. So we are realizing that most conflicts at that particular time were interstate. And that is also to add to what Mustafa said concerning wars between states, wars among states during that particular time, to now states now becoming more, I mean, conflicts becoming more more nationalized, more internal. And when we look at these internal conflicts, many of them arose not entirely because of resources or lack of resources thereof, but because of identity. And therefore, this eventually necessitated the need for countries to come together and sort of harmonize this institution or this court that is going to try cases against people who have been alleged to have been perpetrators of crimes against humanity. And many African countries, from my understanding, were in support of that for a very long time. But eventually, it started being seen as the ICC the ICC targeting African countries. And when now you delve into context, you look at it from a general and a narrow perspective. On a general perspective, it was being said that the ICC is targeting African states based on the fact that there were relations between the ICC and the UNSC, the United Nations Security Council. So I was reading somewhere that the African Union terms the ICC. Sorry about that. I was reading somewhere that the African Union terms the ICC as what is called the International Caucasian Court. And when we talk about neocolonialism now in this context, the AU also further believes that the ICC's relationship with the United Nations Security Council renders the court a neocolonial conspiracy. So that's one perspective to look at it from. Another one is that the basis for the formation of the ICC was not to target African states, because, you know, Africa is not deliberately persecuted by the ICC and the United Nations Security Council. And that is just because neither institution possesses an intention to persecute. Now that's for security, United Nations Security Council, as well as the International Criminal Court. Because on paper, they say that the United Nations Security Council was formed to foster or maintain or promote international peace and security for that matter. But on the other hand, the permanent members of the United Nations Security Council use their veto powers to inhibit ICC intervention outside of Africa that has now led to the AU's perception of persecution. That's how you could argue on those two fronts. Because the AU is... Yeah?
Sorry, go on.
I was actually about to finish. Because they said the AU argues that many cases that are being prosecuted by the ICC tend to be more African-based, whereas they haven't solved any cases in concerning the Syrian crisis, concerning the Syrian conflict. So that leads to a lot of questions being asked in that particular regard.
I mean, yeah, sorry, you really, what I find interesting is apparently the Security Council, or the US specifically, yeah, they have powers to be able to direct cases to the ICC. And what I find really funny about that is that, I mean, from that perspective, it's true. And we're not trying to say that obviously the people that are in the ICC are inherently racist, and that's going to be the end of story. That's a very narrow view. But it's important for us to acknowledge, I mean, you said they tend to be African cases that they're prosecuting. It's 10 out of 11. It's like, I mean, that's a really, really, really high number. Like, I'm sure most people would agree that is disproportionate. And it becomes a question of, are Africans the only ones that can be warlords or criminals? It doesn't really make too much sense to me. And even, I mean, this is again what we'll bring up. So they don't have jurisdiction in the US, although they can investigate the US if the US commits war crimes in other countries. So you know what happened when they actually tried to do that? And I think it was Fatou Bensouda, who's the prosecutor at the ICC. She wanted to actually bring, like, you know, an investigation against the United States for war crimes that were happening in Afghanistan. What happened to her? She was sanctioned. She was sanctioned. Like, they're not even shameful about it. And you know the rhetoric that they used? They said, oh, they want to protect the US citizenry from this renegade court. It's like, what renegade courts? Do you see what I'm saying? It's like, you can't have your cake and eat it. You can't be an imperialist that for the last 100 years has invaded numerous countries on numerous continents, that has plotted against several governments, overthrown several leaders, and essentially installed puppet dictators, and then all of a sudden cry human rights and cry that, oh, we don't want to be investigated. So this is what I mean. It's like, when you're dealing with international organizations, you will, by virtue of a colonial past that has been inherited, that means that resources on the, like, in general, have been unfairly distributed. And I'm not saying that had colonialism not happened, that, you know, countries would not have had more resources than another one. That's what I'm saying. But it's happened to such a degree whereby, right? I mean, the certain statistics were that we're even just looking at, like, you know, the wealth of the rest of the world in compared to the industrialized countries. And in 1976, I believe that was less than half, right? And that's absolutely crazy, right? Considering that those countries that weren't industrialized have a considerable amount of the world population. So that means that automatically international organizations are going to be prone to power concentration. It's going to happen.
The hypocrisy that you speak of, it actually transpires in one man. Like, one man is the epitome of that hypocrisy, which is Mike Pompeo. And Mike Pompeo, when the ICC tried to investigate America for the crimes in Afghanistan, Mike Pompeo called it unlawful because it was under the Trump admin. He called it unlawful for the ICC to investigate America because America was his own autonomous nation. And now, on the flip side, he's at the forefront of leading the charge against China, calling, sanctions, calling investigations, even though despite the investigations of the larger Muslim community outside of the Western hegemonic force, the larger community says that there's nothing going on in China. And Pompeo is now saying there's a genocide going on in Xinjiang specifically. And this is after the fact that he's been invited to go investigate and he's refused the investigation. And in my humble opinion, this is the next stage of the American imperialist machine, in which they put out an outrage, you know, that there's a crime going on supposedly, and they use this to justify war. They use this to justify their next stage of, you know, maintaining dominance, because inadvertently they've been stopping, Iran, the North Korea from gaining power, because essentially they don't want to be at a position where they feel like someone else is more powerful than them at the world stage. But so Mike Pompeo, for me, he's the epitome of that.
Yeah, on the question of China, to be honest, I need to read more on that, but I know for sure something fishy is going on. I don't necessarily think that nothing is happening there, because I've definitely heard testimony and all these different reports. It's more likely than not that something is actually going on that is morally reprehensible. In terms of what that means, it doesn't necessarily mean, for example, like, you know, actually, let me rephrase that. So if you have the US, for example, trying to use that as a leverage to be able to sanction China, et cetera, like, that's very possible that they could do that. It doesn't necessarily mean that in and of itself that a genocide isn't happening, right? And I think that a lot of people need to pay attention to that, because, yeah, we'll discuss. I mean, this is one thing I don't want us to, like, go on a tangent. Someone like Eddie Liga-Smith, who's another TikToker, is a Marxist TikToker.
Yeah.
He brought it up and he talked about how this could possibly be used as a pretext for imperialism. So I guess, like, in terms of from an epistemological point of view, it doesn't necessarily mean that nothing's happening. You know what I'm saying?
Of course. Just because the lack of evidence is not evidence in of itself. But what I'm talking to specifically is the Islamic Organization of Cooperation, which is like 57 member states of Muslim nations, had this concern of genocide early on in around 2014 when the first movement was going on, and based off that, they were invited by China to go actually investigate what was going on in boots on the ground, and Muslims from all over the Muslim world. Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Malaysia went over and saw that there was not only there was no evidence of genocide, but they commended China's efforts for vocational training, for its skills that it was giving to the Uyghur population in Xinjiang. And this is directly opposed to the European forces, the European forces that refused to go. They've been invited countless times to go investigate. They refuse to go, and they purport that a genocide narrative. And this genocide narrative isn't based on any evidence apart from two reports, one from an Australian think tank and another from a German quote unquote researcher that are filled with errors, are filled with inconsistencies that make you think as if that this can't be the only reason that. The Western world is outraged against China. There's got to be something deeper.
Yeah, I think we can definitely discuss all of that in a different context / setting. Although here's what I'll tell people. It's like when you're reading history or when you're looking into different things, especially international relations, it's very rare that you're going to find someone that's the good guy or someone that is, the savior or whatever. So it could even be possible that those different investigations were obviously impeded by certain incentives, or it could be that certain investigations are being pushed by imperialistic narratives. So as of now, obviously, that's something for me to look into and something for listeners to look into as well. But generally speaking, it's quite obvious that when you're using all these different atrocities around the world, we've seen it happening before, right? Where certain states will manufacture claims against other states, and then they'll use that as a pretext for invasion or a pretext for them to actually even take them to the International Criminal Court, for example. But one thing I wanna perhaps also bring up is I've noticed that the leaders, or not necessarily the leaders, people who are holding high positions in this office of the ICC, they actually do happen to be from the African continent. And as you can see, I'm just trying to see. Yes, so essentially it's based in The Hague. 18 judges, but the president is from Nigeria, and Fatou Bensouda is from Gambia, and she's the prosecutor. And I mean, what's your response to that? I mean, do you think that just because there's Africans in the ICC that somehow makes it not racist or not structurally racist in the least?
Absolutely not. They are mere images. They're images to talk to, a diverse concept, different races. But I see similarities in the UK when the Conservative government uses Priti Patel or Rishi Sunak as multicultural people from that are non-white POC, but they are pushing the most backwards, anti-immigration racist positions. But they want us to think that no, it's not, it's the contrary. But I don't buy the fact that just because there's black faces or brown faces in high positions that negates the problem or the issue, which is systemic issues like racism or neocolonialism.
What about you, Mikhail?
I think I also agree with Mustafa in this particular context. And I would find that Bensouda was a little bit more effective than her predecessor, who was this guy, Ocampo. And the main contention that I had with Ocampo was that he instituted so many cases against Africans, but hardly, I mean, almost none of them successfully went through. And that doesn't give any meaning to whatever he was, to whatever he was doing in his capacity as ICC prosecutor, because what matters is not the amount of cases that he institutes, but the number of cases that he successfully prosecutes. So I think that's my take on that, basically.
Yeah, even from a PR perspective, I mean, this is something that we study in criminal law. In an adversarial systems, essentially, where you have prosecutor and you have the prosecution and the defense, both sides, that concept is that, you know, both sides are going to oppose each other and try to essentially win the case. And because both of them are going at it in a very strong fashion, right, against each other with evidence against evidence, that the truth will somehow come out of that. And unfortunately, a byproduct of this, of like, you know, trying to win cases, et cetera, all these different things, you get cases like that where, for example, Ocampo is going all around the African continent just to collect all this information on these different leaders, et cetera. It doesn't necessarily mean that the claims aren't true, because we know that witness tampering is a thing. We know witnesses from different cases go missing or they somehow end up dead in a fishing accident, even though they've never touched a fishing rod in their life. All these different things, you know, it doesn't really, like, I mean, doesn't necessarily mean that it wasn't true. But at the same time, I will also state this. Just because you have black faces in high places doesn't necessarily mean that the concept of structural racism or imperialist or neo-imperialist structures, it does not negate their existence, right? You can do a perfect job as a judge, but you need to look at it in a wider context, right? Who's bringing the cases forward? What cases are you not receiving? And this is exactly what we're here to discuss. We're not here to say that all the cases against Africans should be dropped. That's ridiculous. What we're attempting to at least make the world see is the disproportional focus on the African continent as this continent that still needs civilizing. And it's pushing that narrative. Even though you have Africans in those positions, that's one person, right? There's an entire system that functions around them that dictates very much what they're going to be doing in that courtroom. So even, for example, let's go into a few case studies. I mean, and I want to hear you guys, what your thoughts are. The ICC will not investigate cases where it feels that the country itself is willing to prosecute certain people that have allegedly committed war crimes. For example, in the UK, they decided that, obviously there's the Overseas Operations Bill, where they decided that they were going to take care of their own cases of war criminals and prosecute them themselves within 5 years, right? But by 2017, and I think this is from Vice News, this is where the statistic is, they've taken a statistic from somewhere else, they'd only prosecuted one soldier, but that I think they'd given around £19.2 million in compensation in over 200 cases. Some people would be like, oh wait, but that's a success. That's a success, right? But why are those leaders in European lands who have played a part in committing war crimes, why are they able to pay compensation, but African leaders have to be put in jail? Are we differentiating between certain war crimes? I mean, war criminals? Is a war criminal not a war criminal? Shouldn't the law see everyone equally? We're talking about the rule of law here, and one of the principles of the rule of law is that the law sees everyone equally and should apply to everyone equally, especially in a criminal sense. So, I mean, what do you guys think about that whole dynamic?
There's got to be more. It's impossible. It's literally, if we were to estimate how many prosecutions had to have happened for justice to be delivered, thousands. You know, it's impossible that only one person is guilty of war crime throughout the Iraqi invasion.
And what's even worse is that, I mean, the West, and I'll tell you this straight up, the West will never allow it. The West will never allow a former president of the United States, or imagine a former prime minister of the UK being sent to jail for war crimes. It'll be an affront to the values of the state, right? Imagine people would go mad. Why? Because you have this concept that, oh my goodness, right? When people mention, in quotes, third world countries and these, you know, again, you propagating this imperialist way of thinking, it's like only war crimes can happen in third world countries by third world leaders. This is essentially the rhetoric that the court has communicated to us, right? And we're not saying this isn't we're not saying that this is irreversible, right? We're definitely saying that in the context of what it is today, that the cases have disproportionately focused on the continent. And there's no clear answer as to why.
I think you can extrapolate that onto the social level, where you see police officers who kill black people getting away with it and not serving any time, you know, and just having paid leave, as opposed to the black quote-unquote criminal who's given the book. So the parallel is there.
You know what I think is extremely powerful, and is definitely, it's something that we can, I mean, it's quite sad that we should think of it this way. But if you want to go to the fullest extent of how neocolonialism has manifested in the post-colonial phase of the world, I mean, you could easily say, you know, the way the government has, you know, those three branches, where you have obviously the legislature, you have the judiciary, and you have the executive branch. For me, it just seems pretty much like the ICC is the judiciary for the third world, and the organizations like the IMF and the World Bank, because of structural adjustment programs. And you know, one person actually mentioned it as creating what's called the denationalized state. And the fact that this multilateral state is born, where you have to cede a lot of your sovereignty to international organizations in order to be able to secure money, to pay off certain, I mean, to finance certain projects. They seem as if that the executive, or at least a mixture of the executive and the legislative branches of what's called, in quotes, the third world, according to them. I think it's very, very interesting to just view that dynamic and how international organizations, as I said, are extremely prone to power and power concentration. And by and large, I mean, I'm someone who's more sympathetic to the realist school of thought in international relations. And by and large, you just find that unequal circumstances are being produced, or at least they're being perpetuated by these international organizations. But as we close off, I just want to hear some closing statements from everyone else. And we'll just close off the podcast after that. So let's hear from Mikhail. What do you have to say for us today before we head out?
Yeah, so just wanted also to speak to something that you've mentioned earlier, that the rule of law recognizes that everyone is equal. Now, at the beginning of this discussion, we were looking at international law, like how international law started, and to an extent now eventually the formation of international organizations. So I could say that the modern day state system that we have in place could be traced to 1648 after the signing of the Treaty of Westphalia. And if you look closely, African countries are actually not as Wharton as how Europe was around 500 years ago. That's why many countries in the past, especially the US, didn't want to engage with Europe on the assumption that it was a Wharton continent and therefore its affairs should be left alone. And that's also one of the reasons why the US didn't even join the League of Nations in the first place, because of the reputation that Europe was Wharton and they should be left to be able to deal with their issues alone. So in this particular regard, as we wrap up, I would say that there's also a need to recognize the fact that that's playing a little bit of the devil's advocate, let me call it. It is not that the ICC is being used as a tool by the West to target African countries, but you can also argue through an epistemological approach, of course, that the Rome Statute, which essentially is the cardinal framework of the ICC, presents a new approach to the understanding of sovereignty through individual criminal accountability, rather than the state as the one that had propagated these particular crimes against humanity. So that's what I could say in that particular regard. I could have talked a lot because there's something else that I saw, but it's still fine. We can put this for another day.
Actually, no, if you have something else to say, by all means, add it in. We can just,
okay. So as I did my reading, I'd like you guys to listen to this particular paragraph and offer your critique on the same. So I was doing my reading. This is what I came across. The vetting process and burden of proof required to ensure successful prosecution demonstrates that the ICC intervention in Africa is fair and legitimate. ICC investigations and prosecutions are guided by sound, fair, and transparent principles, which require sufficient evidence to establish the accused committed the offense. Therefore, as the author submits, this stringent judicial analysis means it is highly unlikely that a case built on weak evidence would advance to trial. The author goes further, submitting that even if a case goes to trial, the burden of proof remains on the prosecution to prove guilt beyond reasonable doubt. I think you've learned this, Adnan. These high standards ensure that any case, African or otherwise, is dealt with fairly and legitimately by the court. In fact, the ICC has previously dropped charges against African defendants due to a lack of evidence in the cases of Prosecutor versus Harushimana and the one that we had in Kenya, Prosecutor versus William Ruto and Joshua Arap Sang. So this substantiates the contention that the ICC deals with African situations fairly and legitimately, and that the institution does not have the requisite intent to purposefully persecute African states. So essentially, the ICC deals with African situations the same way as it would have dealt with any non-African situation. And this means that the court does not have an intention to exclusively target Africa. This leads to the conclusion that it is the permanent members of the UNSC, as opposed to the ICC, that are at fault for the AU perception of persecution.
It's good to have critical thoughts, but there's one entire assumption.
Yeah.
That argument is presupposed. It's presupposing, right?
Yeah.
That the cases are being brought from all places, right? It's presupposing this. But tell me, out of these cases that have been brought to trial and have been investigated, why is it not even majority, overwhelming majority? Why are a lot of them actually being focused on the African continent? And additionally, this court is already flawed from the onset, because if, for example, I guarantee you, if it was African countries that were just saying like, okay, you all came across and you wanted to make this court and et cetera to be able to bring justice, right? These countries, I mean, like, you're not gonna exactly have what we're having today. What do we have today? We have an unequal concentration of power, mainly with the US and the West. So the US can actually opt out of it. Same thing for China. And people can also mention Saudi Arabia, et cetera, all these different countries. Those ones we can definitely have a discussion about them, but we're talking mainly about the US, right? They have no jurisdiction for possibly one of the countries that has committed some of the most war crimes. Like, even just to like list them, we can go, I mean, we can start with Vietnam, but we can go as far back as, you know, we can just go as far back. Like, we can keep going back in history and we'll keep finding those things, right? So from the onset, the court is flawed because not all countries are present, number one. Second of all, right, they're talking about the nature of how cases are investigated, not which cases are being investigated. So can they bring us, like, with all due respect, comprehensive answers that are answering those questions? Because we know about the standard of proof. We're not going against that. We know about the evidential rules, all these different things. We affirm that it's an adversarial system and it seems fair from the onset. But to what extent have neo-imperialist structures prevented the ICC from exercising its jurisdiction outside of the African continent? Let them answer that question. Because again, they've kind of strawmanned our position, I feel. But yeah, what do you think, Mustafa?
Yeah, there's a distinction between the law and what transpires. Because for the most part, the same argument could be made elsewhere. Oh, there are no racist laws. Well, why are Black people disproportionately arrested, or why are Black people disproportionately stopped? Just because, you know, philosophically, on paper, something's, you know, objective, reasonable, the way it transpires is completely different. And like you said, why not go after America? The evidence is overwhelming, you know. And the prime example being the crimes committed in Abu Ghraib, in which they themselves took pictures. They themselves were proud of their crimes, you know, the soldiers, that is. And when they go to America, they serve what? No longer than a few years. And then all of them are free right now. I believe one of them actually committed suicide. But America and the UK and their crimes, I think, are equal, if not more severe than all of the crimes committed in Africa throughout the various years of war due to imperialism and colonialism.
I mean, and that's even a conversation for another day, but one of the reasons why we're in this pickle in the first place is this idea of colonialism, the fact that you can appropriate resources for such a long time, and by the end of that process, expect countries to get up and somewhat trade with you on an equal basis, or to assume that in the absence of reparations, that Africa and the rest of global South countries would be able to sustain economies to the same degree as those Western imperialist nations. It doesn't make sense. From the onset, it doesn't make sense, right? And most definitely, you talked about that, right? But obviously, I mean, people could definitely argue that those cases in courts have passed the statute of limitations, but I would love to see cases for compensation being brought up against these nations. Compensation and this idea of what is going to be repaid because of the damage that was done due to colonialism. A lot of people are going to tell us to forget about colonialism, etc. And honestly, if you really study global political economy in the last 100 to 200 years, you'll see how irrational it is for anyone to discount colonialism and imperialism and the effects that they've had on the African continent in deciding where our economies are today. And I'm not trying to say that our leaders are somewhat innocent. That is not what I'm trying to say. But it's definitely an important thing we need to look at. But yeah, let's close off the podcast. And I believe Mustafa, did you have anything else to say before we close off?
No, just the fact that they are extensions of white supremacy, the ICC, that is, that they serve the interest of Western powers. And that's my thoughts on it, pretty much. I don't see it as any different from the internal disparities, the internal oppression of Western governments. I see it as something that it extends to use as a tool against African nations. But those are my thoughts.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mustafa. In summation, I would probably also, to an extent, agree with that statement and possibly just say that the ICC cannot function as a fully independent court, first of all. And this is one of the issues with international relations, right? I believe that power and justice are interrelated. So whoever has the most power to avoid justice or to dish it out. And on that basis, they can decide who gets the justice and who does not get that justice, right? And you can just read, obviously, the works of John Locke, Thomas Hobbes, etc. They speak about, you know, this concept of, you know, the state of nature, etc. And some international relations theorists actually argue that states as of in and of themselves are like a smaller version, I mean, or a larger version of the state of nature, where there's no sovereign or there's no sole power that can control everything. But at times, as we've mentioned, due to imperialism, all these different things, get certain powers that clash together, and some are clashing for that monopoly on power, right? And those nations, those states are the ones who decide things the way they should be essentially, and they essentially decide what happens, especially in this question of what justice truly means. So definitely, I think it's been a productive podcast. I would myself say that the ICC cannot function in a fair way unless there's some conception of redistribution of power that was taken in the form of resources, raw materials, etc., from countries that were colonized, etc. We cannot have that conversation. It cannot be able to dish out justice properly without considering that, because all the powerful nations can easily avoid justice by, all these different semantics, or they can even just have the power to say straight up no. So thank you so much, Mikhail. Thank you so much, Mustafa. Honestly speaking, season 13 has come to a very, it started off very well. And I mean, if you guys want to say a quick goodbye or drop your socials, then feel free to do so.
Yeah, for sure. They drop them in the chat, or how do we do this?
Just say them out loud, bro.
Okay, Mikhail Nyamoya, that's for Instagram. You can get me on Instagram through that.
And you can follow me at Fear and Trembling without a G on TikTok.
Awesome, guys. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you to everyone who's listening. The YouTube channel is up, and hopefully we're going to be getting a few more videos every second Friday out. And yeah, thank you guys so much. And we will see you in the next episode.